Thank you, Ruth and Heidi. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're all kind of moving on holiday time, I think, but we're moving. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. Don't know that we have any visitors or new people today, but you know, all of you, that we welcome, I hope you know this, we welcome you no matter where you are on your journeys. We welcome you no matter the color of your skin, your sexual preference, your, your genders,
whatever.
Your health, wherever you are in life's journey, especially wherever you are in the spiritual journey, in the sacred path, we welcome you. And of course, we always invite you, if there's anyone who hasn't been here before, to come here more than once, because our services are very different on different Sunday mornings. The opening words are these, written by Alfred S. Cole. Into the bright circle of life and light, which is the Christmas season, we have come to warm our hearts and minds at the cradle of the child. May something of the beauty, mystery, and promise of this lovely old story fall like silver rain upon the broken dreams, the hates, and fears of all. Once again, may we pause, look up, and in the far-off distances, hear that old, old music. The music of hope, brotherhood, sisterhood, and blessed peace. And that is why I chose We Three Kings of Orient Are for today's opening hymn, not your traditional Unitarian Universalist hymn. But I want to invite you to try to interpret the words more objectively and universally than you might otherwise be inclined to do. And remember, always take into account when things are written. In this case, well over 100 years ago. So we have these wealthy men, these kings, taking off on what is essentially a wild goose chase, a snipe hunt, a search for meaning, for goodness, for light in a dark, troubled, violent world. In the darkest time of the year. And isn't that exactly what we are all doing? No matter our theology, what we are all in search of, meaning, goodness, light, peace on earth. So the first verse sets the scene. This is number 259. And then I like to think of the next three verses as the past, the present, and then the future. You know, a bit like where Dickens was going with Scrooge. You will quickly note that in that second verse, it's very, a lot of God language in that second verse, but that's okay. It was written a long time ago, and it's talking about the past, the way things were when this person was writing, the way things were theologically. The third verse is about the present and about how this new life, the babe they're looking for, is probably going to have a troubled life. Nobody escapes that. And then, of course, the fourth verse, which is full of joy and wonder and finding the love and the light. So I invite you now to sing number 259 with a slightly different take. To face the world's coldness, a chalice of warmth. To face the world's terrors, a chalice of courage. To face the world's turmoil, a chalice of peace. May its glow fill our spirits, our hearts, and our lives. Grandmother's House, a short reading by Unitarian Universalist minister Christopher Buse. He writes, over the river and through Atlanta traffic, to grandmother's house we'd go. That was our routine, during various family holiday gatherings of my childhood. I remember looking at all the foods spread out on Grandma's dining room table. There was a large turkey roasted to a golden brown. There were salads, casseroles, dressing, freshly baked rolls, and a variety of vegetables to choose from. But these were of no interest to me. There was only one dish that mattered. It was served in an elegant, fine china bowl with a ladle to the side. It was a delicious, piping hot bowl of SpaghettiOs. I was always excited to see that Grandma had cooked my favorite dish. She had lovingly opened the can, poured the contents into a pot, and warmed them to perfection. And of course, there was the presentation. I am probably one of the few people on earth who has been served SpaghettiOs from the finest china. My grandmother was a Southern Baptist. My father, her son, became an Episcopal priest. I, writes Buse, am a Unitarian Universalist minister. Perhaps this is the trickle-down theory operating in religion. Grandma died before I became a member of a UU church. I am not sure how she would have reacted. Perhaps she would have felt the same as my aunt, who once exclaimed to my brother, Sam, "Chris is a Unitarian. I thought he was at least an Episcopalian." This was not a diplomatic comment, considering that Sam is an Episcopal priest. Would my grandmother be surprised by my choice? Maybe not. Grandma taught me from earliest childhood that there is room at the table for someone who is a little bit different from the rest. The memory of that bowl of SpaghettiOs continually reminds me to make room in my heart for people who are a bit odd in their tastes and dispositions. There can be room in our hearts for diversity. There can be a place at the table for everyone, even the more finicky children of the universe. Well, there should be a place at the table for everyone, even the more finicky children of the universe. That is one of the two most important things that I think Jesus was trying to teach us. Now, there'll be several references to the fellowship of the open table, to inviting everyone to that table in the next few minutes. But first, a story, a true story, that I revisit every year at this time as I contemplate my relationship with that historical figure we know as Jesus. I have told this story before. Some of you have probably heard it. Please do not react until the end. But like any good story, it is worth the retelling. When I was a seminary student living in Berkeley in the mid-1990s, one beautiful spring day, I went to the bank, made a deposit, received a deposit slip, stuck it in my pocket, and took it home. When I got home and was putting my banking items away, I checked that deposit slip to make sure it agreed with my figures, and I was appalled to see at the bottom of that slip these words, "Thank you, Jesus." What? I couldn't believe it. No whispering. Okay, those fundamentalists are everywhere, I thought. Second-year seminary student, yeah. How dare they put their personal theology on the bottom of my bank deposit statement? I called the bank. The person I spoke to seemed as indignant as I was, and she immediately put her supervisor on the line. "What?" said the supervisor. "I can't believe it." She asked me to send her a copy of my statement. I did, immediately feeling righteous for doing my little part in pushing back the inroads the religious right were making. The supervisor responded to me within days. She was sheepish. I could hear it in her voice. She said, "Did you know that most of the tellers put their names on the bottom of bank slips they hand to you?" "No," said I. "Neither did I," she said. "And not only that, they usually type in the word thanks followed by their name. And the name of the teller you went to the other day is Jesus." A common name at that time, certainly in the San Francisco Bay Area. So much for religious righteousness. Who is this person that I am so fearful of having shoved down my throat? And why do Unitarian Universalists tend to be reluctant to talk about him? Why are we so willing to give him up to the fundamentalists or even to more moderate Christians? I don't think we should let him go without a fight. The man is way too valuable to let him slip away from our awareness. When we reject all of Christianity, we are in danger of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, almost literally. I am interested in doing some reclaiming work about Jesus, the person. Now, please note that I am not talking about the post-Easter Jesus. That's a subject for another day. Flannery O'Connor once described Jesus as that ragged figure flitting from tree to tree in the back of the mind. End of her quote. He haunts us, sneaks up on us, pursues us, especially this time of year. Now, this can be problematic for those of us, like myself, who were raised as Christians, happily raised as a Christian, but don't necessarily describe ourselves as Christians anymore. Someone once asked me what my relationship is to Jesus. This was in a church I served in South Eastern Iowa. I probably should have told him my Jesus story, although I'm not sure he would have seen the humor in that. But I thought a minute and I said, well, I don't have any relationship or connection to Jesus in the sense of his being my savior or of my having to be born again in Christ. However, I would like to have a relationship with Jesus that consisted of my emulating his life, following his teachings. I think I am coming full cycle in this relationship. As a child in that Presbyterian church in which I grew up in, I would have had no trouble seeing Jesus as pagan, Jew, Christian, heretic, rabble-rouser, peacenik, warrior, in a nonviolent way, of course. As a child, I grasped that. I had amazingly good Sunday school teachers who seemed to understand that A, Jesus could not be put in a box and easily defined, and B, the life of Jesus was much more important than his death and what happened or didn't after his death. Of course, we were Presbyterians, so we already knew some people were saved and some people weren't, so we needed to get into that. But nevertheless, they were very good at this. From time to time, we Unitarian Universalists do show a renewed interest in Jesus. It's, you know, kind of cyclical. I think that has a great deal to do with what I said about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Several years ago, there was an article about Jesus, and it was actually the lead story in an issue of our UU World magazine. The title of the article was "Seeing Jesus with Modern Eyes." The author quoted, as that author probably should have, Unitarian minister Theodore Parker, who preached what turned out to be one of the most controversial sermons in UU history in the year 1841. Some of you know about this, because some of you know who Theodore Parker was. I'll probably mention him again on Martin Luther King Day because Parker had a gun up here because he was such an abolitionist that the mobs would sometimes throw rocks through the window and try to cause him harm. But Theodore Parker preached a sermon in which he said, "So the Christianity of Jesus is permanent, though what passes for Christianity with popes and catechisms with sects and churches in the first century or the 19th century prove transient also. In other words, but one of the biographies of Parker is this thick, so I'm trying to say all that in like 2 minutes. Parker maintained that it didn't matter if someone named Jesus put out these radical ideas, I would maintain they're still radical, about peace on earth, loving each other. It didn't matter if that person happened to be named Jesus, that these ideas would come out of our human spirit eventually. So that Christianity was permanent, he meant the ideas, those radical ideas for which Jesus was killed. That's permanent. Everything else, popes, sects, churches, is transient. It's not permanent. Well, Theodore Parker got in a whole bunch of trouble for that sermon. He was almost excommunicated. Which, yes, we do that. We've done it once, officially. Some of you will know who Elaine Pagels is. Name might sound familiar to you. Pagels is the leading authority in the world on Christianity's suppressed gospels. And you may have heard of some of her books, the Gnostic Gospels, maybe, or the Gospel of Thomas. She has studied the Nag Hammadi texts buried by ancient monks to protect them from a rash of reactionary book burnings in the period following Jesus' death. Now, these aren't to be confused with the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are about ancient Judaism. The Nag Hammadi texts are all about Jesus. They portray Jesus as a mystic, and they give credit to his pagan leanings. Their Jesus in the Nag Hammadi text is Zen-like, imaginative, poetic. He is portrayed as androgynous and as having a yin-yang duality. There's a reason these texts have been suppressed, and they still are. The Nag Hammadi texts were written by Gnostics from that Greek word gnosis, which connotes a kind of direct, intuitive knowledge, as opposed to what Unitarians love, analytical knowledge, also opposed to belief based on faith. Now, you might not be surprised to learn that Orthodox movements in ancient times wanted to suppress teachings about this type of experience because such experiences are pretty much beyond the control of an institution. Oh, wait a minute, silly me. What am I saying? Orthodox movements in ancient times wanted to suppress knowledge that people claim to have intuitively? I think that's still very much with us. In the interest of accuracy, I think I should say that Orthodox movements in all times try to suppress this kind of knowledge. There are some parts of Gnosticism that I embrace, most notably that idea that we can know things intuitively, even if they can't be learned or taken on faith. Knowing something intuitively isn't the same thing as taking something on faith. It can be, but it isn't necessarily. Redheaded Robbie in that story intuitively knew what were the most important aspects of Christmas. Give before you take, show kindness to someone new, and forgive a person who has hurt you. Children often know things intuitively until we drum it out of them. So, was Jesus a mystic, a pagan, a peacenik, a warrior, a friend, an enemy, an enigma? A case can be made that Jesus was all of these and more. The historical Jesus was a complicated person. Although there are many aspects of him that we know little about, we would do well to emulate his actions, especially during this month in which we celebrate his birthday. For me and for Elaine Pagels and for many others, Jesus is every person. And if he is every person, that is, he has the capacity to completely empathize with others. Think about that. How much empathizing do we really do with each other? We do a little, but to be able to completely empathize with others, So if Jesus is every person, then it doesn't matter what we personally believe about him in the theological sense, because there are many paths to truths, many ways to be spiritual and religious. I think it is sad, and I would go so far as to say, yes, even sinful, to portray Jesus narrowly. Oh, here's an example. Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of Christ. How many of you saw it? I figured nobody had. I saw it. I did see it because I didn't feel I could critique it without seeing it. I almost didn't make it through because not only was it theologically wrong, it was one of the worst movies that I've ever seen. I mean, the whole screenplay and the costuming and the torture of Jesus was campy. I mean, bad. What a disservice Gibson did to the character of Jesus. Give me Jesus Christ Superstar any day. Here is a wonderful story about knowledge through intuition. A few years ago, at the Seattle Special Olympics, 9 contestants, all physically or mentally disabled, assembled at the starting line for the 100-yard dash. At the gun, they all started out, not exactly in a dash, but with a relish to run the race to the finish and win. All that is, except for one little boy who stumbled on the asphalt, tumbled over a couple of times, and began to cry. The other 8 heard the boy cry. They slowed down, they looked back, and then they all turned around and went back, every one of them. One girl with Down syndrome bent down and kissed him and said, "This will make it better." Then all 9 linked arms and walked together to the finish line. Everyone in the stadium stood, and the cheering went on for several minutes. People who were there are still telling this story. Why? Well, maybe because deep down we know this one thing. What matters in this life is more than winning for ourselves. What matters in this life is helping others win, even if it means slowing down and changing our course. What matters is making room for everyone at the table. Those kids knew intuitively how to welcome everyone to the table. Jesus would be appalled, I think, if he were here today and witnessed the things that are done in his name. Jesus did not want people to worship him. He simply lived a life that is worth, if not worshiping, then certainly copying. My brother loves to use a one-liner for grace before meals. "Jesus is neat. Let's eat." Well, Jesus is neat and radical. And that is the second thing I hope you will take away with you today. Jesus as revolutionary. Jesus as radical. Remember, he was killed for his beliefs. 10 years ago at the protest in Georgia for the school of, well, against the School of the Americas, which I know is another name, but I think most of us still know it by School of the Americas, I came across a wonderful little book by a Catholic priest, John Deere. The book is Jesus the Rebel. In that, Deere says that Jesus' public life became a string of civil disobedience actions against injustice. But the culture of violence in which he lived, does that sound familiar? The culture of violence did not understand this way of nonviolence. The culture of Jesus' time, which is so similar to our own, glorified violence. Indeed, even encouraged addiction to violence, which I think this culture we are in right now does. But Jesus stood firm in his path of nonviolence. Jesus summons us to that spirituality of nonviolence, calling us to reject violence and its fallout of despair, doubt, domination, and especially since 9/11, fear. That is the real Jesus, the one who fights nonviolently for peace and justice, the one who says there's room at the table for all of us. He didn't just say that, of course. He acted that way. Some of you will know or remember from your own, perhaps, Christian upbringing, that Jesus befriended everyone, and he dined with the lowest of the low. The prostitutes, the tax collectors, for example. What would Jesus do? You remember those bracelets that mostly kids wore, WWJD? Well, to borrow a phrase from Rebecca Parker, who was president of Starr King Seminary when I was there, she's not related to Theodore Parker, I don't think. According to Rebecca, Jesus would do whatever serves life. I once saw a newspaper article that asked, what would Jesus drive? Well, he wouldn't drive, that is. He would use mass transportation. Or he would walk, or hitchhike, or bicycle. Whatever best serves life, that would be the determining factor in how he got around, as it should be ours. I have one more short story of my own for you, and then a poem to wrap up. Here's my second story. It's Christmas season, the first Sunday after New Year's Day, 2001. I am with my dad in my original home church, that Presbyterian one in northwestern Pennsylvania. Northwestern Pennsylvania isn't exactly a bastion of liberalism. But in that church, many of the people have known me or did know me since I was a baby. They had a guest speaker that morning, a man who was pre-candidating for a position in a Presbyterian church in a nearby town. I'm sort of daydreaming during his sermon when suddenly I hear the words, Unitarian Universalist and blasphemy. Huh? I snapped to attention. Seems the guest minister had attended a Unitarian Universalist service, Christmas Eve service, and could not understand why the UU minister had never once mentioned God or said that Jesus was the Son of God or anything about whether Jesus was a divine being or not. All that the minister said on that Christmas Eve was that Jesus was the ultimate lover of peace and that we would do well to emulate him. So, yes, what's the problem? Sounds to me like the minister at that Christmas Eve service managed to capture the essence of the real Jesus. Jesus as nonviolent, Jesus as lover of peace, as the host who invites everyone to the table. We would indeed do well to emulate his lifestyle. I would like to end my reflections with a poem that was written by Carl Dennis, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2002. The poem is titled, Jesus Freaks. The approval they get from above is all they need. So why should they care if they offend me here in the parking lot of the Super Duper, my arms full, by stuffing a pamphlet or two in my pocket? No point in shouting at them to keep back when they're looking for disapproval. No reason for them to obey the rules of one of the ignorant who supposes the perpetual dusk he lives in, sunny noon. Their business is with my soul. However buried, with my unvoiced wish for the truth, too soft for me to catch over the street noise. Should I rest my packages on my car a minute and try to listen if I'm sure they really believe they're vexing me in my own best interest? To them, I'm the loser they used to be when they sweated daily to please themselves, deaf to their real wishes. Why make it easy for me to load the trunk of my car with grocery bags when they offer a joy that none of my purchases, however free of impurities, can provide? Their calls to attention shouldn't sound any more threatening than the peal of a church bell. And if I call on the car phone to lodge a complaint, jail will seem to them the perfect place to bear witness in this dark dominion where Herod rules. In jail, but also guests at a banquet, while I, they're certain, stubbornly stand outside, shivering in the snow, too proud to enter a hall not of my own devising, and warm myself at a fire I didn't light, and enjoy a meal strangers have taken pains with. Yes, the table's crowded, but there's room for me. Now, I don't intend to become a Jesus freak. I do intend to try to keep in my awareness the real Jesus, the one I understood as a child and am now coming back to understanding. That Jesus is every person. That Jesus tells us that everyone must be seated at the table. And until that happens, we better get out there and work for peace and justice as nonviolent people, of course. Out of these two components of the real Jesus, his belief in the open table fellowship and his commitment to nonviolence, out of these two flow everything else that you need to know about Jesus. There is a book, Al, you may be aware of it, and I'm blanking on the author and the title, that it's it takes the New Testament and it puts the supposed words of Jesus in different colors, and because the different colors signify things he might have said, things he probably never ever did say, and then possibly what someone whom we call Jesus might have said. And I think those are in red, not real sure. There's not much of that. But you also have to always remember when reading ancient things, this includes the Bible, of course, metaphor. You're not supposed to take it literally, unless you're in some churches, maybe. And as I said a few minutes ago, Jesus would be appalled to come back. He did not want to be worshipped as a person. And Al, there was a historical Jesus. I was a history major. There's way too much proof on that side. It may have been an amalgam, is that the right word, of different people. But there was, just as there was a Confucius, but it was probably more than one person. But I think you hit on part of it, but I think it's that orthodox thing. You have to try to break out of the box. You have to think differently. I give you the current Pope, who's trying to do a little bit of this, but he's still not going to make systemic changes. Still not going to say women can be. It's that old way of thinking, and it's over there, and now we need to learn Spanish, which I'm going to do, and go over here. You know, there's a whole new way of thinking. There really is. So I think you just stumble, you're stumbling into things that's not true of all Christian churches by any means, what you heard. You will not find a more, be seated, amazing, wonderful Christian than a man named Howard Thurman. And some Sunday I'll tell you more about him. The closing words are his, and it's number 615 in the back if you want to read silently along. When the song of angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flock, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among the brothers and sisters, to make music in the heart. Go make music in your heart. And a happy new year.